Well, here he is, folks. Here comes the Cooter!
Welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to get back to our guest, John Casty, the scientist and author of Mood Matters, an interesting piece because it has a kind of a radical assertion that all social events ranging from all kinds of trends and who gets elected and what's going on with the economy are biased by the attitudes a society holds towards the future. And we're going to pick up where we left off with John, who says that it's kind of cyclical. I mean, that we kind of do all these things in mass. So we've got John coming up, and of course, the end of the program, listener comments, the voice of reason. And we're going to check in with Paul Lynch, who is the British Consul General, and ask him about what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. So right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here in the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay now, old spirit of the fountain. Here is today's query. How many degrees of latitude separate the North and South Poles?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the other.
Okay. How many degrees of latitude separate the North and South Poles? If you guessed 180, you were correct. Okay, right now we're going to return to our guest for the previous half hour, John Casty, who is speaking to us from Vienna, Austria, on the findings of his book, Mood Matters, that says that the events are based on the attitudes a society holds toward the future. John, fascinating in his contention that in mass, we all feel bad about the future or good about the future, and it goes in cycles.
Events don't matter. What matters is the internal dynamics of how the social mood is generated from a collection of individuals and how it changes. And nobody actually really understands that process very well at all. It's a little bit like the way an epidemic might emerge in a population of people through individuals who get sick and pass it on to somebody else, and then eventually it dies out. And it's very unclear how this process actually works. But what is clear is, and I have a lot of information about that in Mood Matters, what's clear is that there is no feedback. As far as events are concerned, events certainly do not affect how the social mood gets formed. So there's not a self-fulfilling spiral prop. Now, as far as controlling the social mood, that's a really interesting question. You know, you're really asking, how is it you can make people happy? How can people become happy when they're currently sad? And if you look at what's happening in the economy today, you know, government projects to pump money into the economy and bail out banks or whatever. In a sense, these are efforts to try and make people happy. They don't usually work very well, and they're not working very well now either, because they're some kind of efforts from the outside, so to speak. Ultimately, people's unhappiness more or less bottoms out, and there is some kind of natural dynamic in social groups that brings them back to being happy again. And then the process repeats itself on different cycles.
It's like mass mental illness, I mean, mass depression, and then it bottoms out, and then we're just plain happy again, no matter what the circumstances, and then everything comes back.
It doesn't flip overnight, you know. These cycles, especially long-term ones like we're in now, it's like steering an oil tanker. If you want to get it going in a different direction, you have to start far ahead, and you can't make huge swings. But it does happen, and the historical record is very clear on this point, and it's clear on all timescales that things go in cycles, and at some point, everybody who's susceptible to being unhappy is unhappy. There's nobody left to become unhappy. And then the cycle starts turning around.
Right. Well, John, tell us about the Kinos Circle. This is that Vienna-based Society for Exploration of the Future. You're a co-founder of that. What does it do? And where are you with that? How long have you been doing this?
Well, this is something that I started together with a colleague here who happened to be a finance guy. He owns a big commodities brokerage house in Vienna. And we were, of course, interested in this question of exploration of the future. And I gathered, it's not a society that someone joins, it's really a society of fellows that are there by invitation, really. Mm-hmm. And what unites us, I mean, we have very different backgrounds. A couple of people who are journalists, some are guys in the finance world or write financial newsletters, some are academic economists or mathematicians, computer scientists like me. But we're all united in a wish to have a little bit more systematic understanding of not only how the future unfolds, but how it is that, to get back to your earlier question, how it is that we might be able to have some influence on how it unfolds. And so our activities, for the most part, we put on a couple times a year international conferences on different themes, changes like peak oil problem, or cycles and patterns in history and finance, or issues that are of importance mostly to the business community. I would say that the customers, if you want to call them that, for our events are primarily from the commercial sector and maybe government policy people. They're not really events for academics per se, although some of the people who attend are academics.
So if I was a dress manufacturer and I wanted to know whether I should come out with long or short hemlines next year, I should call you at the Kinos Circle and get your predictions on what it's going to be, and you're pretty right most of the time?
Well, you could say that. Actually, it's a good example that you chose, because that particular one about skirt lengths and colors of fashion, how they change, is a topic that I take up in Mood Matters, and for reasons not entirely clear to me, a lot of journalists and bloggers have picked up on that particular example in my book since the book appeared a couple weeks ago, and I see in the blogosphere now lots of references to the idea that when people are optimistic about the future, that typically that results in shorter skirts and brighter colors. And when people start getting pessimistic, the fashion trends usually move to the dark side of the color spectrum, and the skirt lengths start going down. And again, this is illustrated with some pretty nice pictures in the book Mood Matters.
So if we're all really super happy, then we'll all be nudists, is what you're really having.
Well, you know, there's a limit. In fact, the limit, as you may recall from the times of miniskirts, the limits, it can get pretty short.
Well, I guess so. All right. Well, give us a future prediction for us. Tell us something we can count on for the future. What do you have?
Oh, I'm glad you put in that caveat about counting on, because that makes the answer easy. You can't count on anything.
Right.
Other than the future will be there. But if you look in the book Mood Matters, the last chapter of the book takes up some issues of this kind. But in the end, all I can say, it's like saying, can you count on the weather? Well, you can't really count on it. All you can say is that given particular conditions, you know, temperature, wind velocities, humidity, and whatever, certain things are more likely to happen than others at certain times. And that's what I take up in the last chapter of my book.
Global warming. I mean, is that the future, or is it all a bunch of malarkey?
Well, it's not really a social event, but I'll give you my personal take on it for what it's worth. The climatological record is very clear that the Earth's climate goes in cycles, and with or without human beings being around. So it's not at all surprising that you would have periods of hot and wet and cool and dry and everything in between. So the record for the last couple hundred years has been a remarkably benign one. We've been living in a period in which the climate in general has been very, very gentle for human life. So it doesn't surprise me to see that we might be moving into a more extreme domain, and the degree to which, though, human activity is pushing that process, is that's the issue of debate. Would we be in more or less the same situation if we weren't, even if we weren't shooting all this carbon and other greenhouse gases and so on into the atmosphere? Nobody can really answer that definitively with 100% assurance. In fact, this is the whole essence of the global warming debate. And there's a second side to this entire coin that some talk about, but it's not very much discussed, and not as much as I think it should be, and that is maybe what we're going to end up with instead of global warming is an onset of a new ice age, just the opposite of global warming, a global cooling. And it's happened before, and if it does happen, it's a lot faster than global warming. It's the kind of thing that can happen in a decade or less. So I'm not placing any bets on one side or the other. I think global warming is still somewhat more likely, but I also think that the role of human activity in precipitating it is basically overblown.
On a personal note, how do you find Vienna? You live in Vienna, what, and you speak perfect English, so I presume that you are an American living in Vienna, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, I came here a long time ago when the institute that I'm a researcher at, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, was first formed in 1973. I came here at that time. I stayed for a few years, then went back to the United States, was a professor at New York University in Princeton, then came back to Vienna. Then I went back to the United States when the Santa Fe Institute was formed, and I stayed there for several years. But now I'm back, and Vienna's like a black hole. You know, I tried to escape, but it doesn't work. So now I'm just relaxing and enjoying it.
Sitting on the side of the Danube River and letting your mind wander so you can write your next book, I presume. Is that right?
Actually, I'm sitting in the center of Vienna, just a couple hundred meters from the cathedral, which is where my flat happens to be located. But it's occasionally I get out to the Danube to do just what you said. In fact, I read recently that Vienna was voted the city that has the highest quality of life of any major city in the world, and while I don't necessarily believe that we're number one, I'm sure that we're in the first five, and I've seen it unfold over 37 years, and each year it gets a little bit better and a little nicer, so I'm not trying to escape anymore.
Yeah, not really. It doesn't sound like you're trying to escape. It sounds like you're really enjoying Vienna. How is the language? Everyone there pretty much speak English as they do in the rest of Europe, or did you have to pick up, German?
Well, you know, every now and then I get forced into saying something in German or listening, but the truth of the matter is the international community in Vienna is so gigantic, and the tourist business here is so huge that essentially everybody speaks English for all practical purposes. So it's a good city for a guy like me who's not very talented in language to begin with.
And they still are performing Strauss quite often. I guess you're going to attend the opera that's going on there later on this month and go listen to Johann's music?
You don't have to go to the opera. You know, people have the image of Vienna as a place where they're waltzing in the street and vast expanses of cream. It's not that far off the mark.
Well, your book is Mood Matters, and I understand that Amazon hasn't been able to keep it in stock. It's had to go back to be reprinted, several times now, is that right?
Well, reprinting, it's on the second printing now, but Amazon has reordered at least half a dozen times in the couple weeks that the book has been out.
You've been fascinating. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. John Casti, his new book, Mood Matters. You can get it on Amazon because they just reordered a bunch. And you've been a delight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's great being with you. Thanks for the opportunity, Colonel. Good talking with you.
So, if you believe in global warming or not, maybe it is time that we gave up our dependence on oil. Could LG replace oil? And how does British Petroleum feel about that? Well, with the current things that are going on in the Gulf of Mexico, we decided to ask Paul Lynch, the British Consul General for the Southwestern United States.
Absolutely. I was talking to somebody in a large oil company. I won't mention the name, but I don't think it's anything proprietary because I think all the oil companies are interested in this technology.
Well, Chevron is one of them, and I believe ExxonMobil just signed a deal with Geomedica, if I have that pronunciation right. I have to check my notes on that. So there is movement in that direction, and of course you've got a big oil industry in British Petroleum and Shell. So I was wondering what you might be able to tell us about that.
It looks potentially promising. The problems at the moment, I think some of the mechanisms are quite well known, and the problems at the moment are scaling them up in economics. If you were to grow algae, my understanding is in the normal way as we do at the moment, and try to harvest oil from it, it wouldn't be economic for two reasons. One, you need a huge land area to grow that amount of algae to get a reasonable amount of oil out of it. And two, the harvesting process to sort of squeeze the oil out is quite expensive, and in itself energy intensive. So you've got to worry about is this an energy positive process or not. So I think what people are looking at the moment, and I know certainly companies here in Texas are looking at the moment, are developing algae that secrete oil, so you don't have to harvest it. You can have a much denser farming of algae. And if they secrete the oil themselves so that you can just take it off and then get it to your refinery and turn it into all the different products that you need, it's a lot less energy intensive and costly program. But we're quite a way away, I think, from that being a major source of fuels. And this goes back to what I was talking about just a few minutes ago, that we're looking at 20, 30, 50-year timescales to put ourselves on a new energy track, and this is a key part when we talk about any of these alternatives, and we need to explore all of them. We need to look at algae, we need to look at wind and wave, we need to look at solar. What we're talking about is we're taking the first steps on a new energy future, which is maybe 100 years away, and certainly we're talking decades in the transition. And what I'm trying to get across when I'm talking to people is that if we try and picture ourselves where we are 100 years from now, we don't know where that's going to be, but we do know it's going to be very different from where we are right now. And algae may be a part of that. Nuclear may well be a part of that. Wind and solar and all the others, and geothermal will be a part of that. Fossil fuels will almost certainly be a part of that. And we need to be exploring all of these options. And they create wonderful opportunities. Whenever you do scientific research and plunge into new worlds of technology, you never end up quite where you thought you were going to be, but you end up with lots and lots of other benefits coming out of it. One example, talking about the space program, for example, and we're very keen in the UK to be involved in space exploration and the commercialization, if you like, and industrialization of space, and having private companies rather than just government entities sending rockets into space and sending up satellites and doing experiments and so on, because it can have tremendous benefits. And one of the benefits of GPS, which was put up as originally as a military application, we all know about it now in our phones and our cars, is it's helping to feed the world. Being able to track where ships are going has dramatically reduced the amount of food that's lost, that's spoiled, because it's in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's sitting in a port. I'm told that we've increased world food production by 7 or 8% simply through better tracking through GPS.
Whoa.
So as we get involved in these new technology areas, they start to spin out benefits that we never thought of before.
All right. Well, we seem to agree, and you, with all the leading scientists, that technology is going to solve the global warming problem in the long run. And you touched base a little bit in off the line about nanotechnology and energy future. Could you fill us in on that?
I'd like to talk about that just for a second. And I'm reminded your comment that I'm confident that we'll.
we will solve these problems reminds me of Winston Churchill's quote that I'm an optimist because I don't see much point in being anything else. And I am an optimist. I think we will find solutions to these problems, and particularly in the United States, where once it really grasps with a problem and throws resources at it, and gets, you know, the finest minds and the finest universities in the world working with industry and developing market-based solutions, the potential for finding solutions and for business growth in this is enormous. Nanotechnology is a fascinating one as a supporting technology in a number of areas, and I think we're just beginning to see some of the potential for nanotechnology in energy production. And we had a group of British companies come across to OTC, to the big oil and gas conference in Houston in May, to talk to people here in Houston at Rice University and other academics in Texas who are involved in nanotechnology about what they're doing and how it might possibly be useful in the future. So you'll be aware of some of the ideas that companies are looking at using nanoparticles, for example, for fracking in tight and shale gas plays. So instead of pumping water into the rocks and breaking up the rocks that way and releasing the gas, water being a very valuable commodity, finding some nanoparticles that can do the job more efficiently and cheaply. People developing nanoparticles that can go down oil wells. And they've got tiny radio transmitters inside these nano shells, and send back information on the condition at the bottom of the well and the pressures and what's going on down there. So we can be even more efficient in developing our fossil fuels. Just to divert slightly from nanotech, but that's incredibly important. We're going to need these fuels. One of the reasons why we should be looking at alternative fuels now is because we're going to continue to need oil for a long time in the future for all sorts of reasons apart from energy. It's the basis of our plastics industry. Mm-hmm. And all the oil that we're burning is oil that we cannot be used to make plastic. So the smarter use of the fossil fuels that we have and stretching out that limited resource is an important thing for the energy industry, and nanotechnologies are going to help us to do that.
Well, there's airplane fuel too that we've got to worry about. I don't see a replacement for fossil fuels with airplane fuel, and even spacecraft, rocket launching. We use a very dirty mix of kerosene and other things like that to get our rockets in the air. I don't know we're going to see any change in that anytime soon.
Absolutely. What we've talked about mostly when we've talked about alternative energy production with solar and wind and so on, it has been electricity production, you know, power plants, but not transportation. And transportation is essentially where all the oil goes at the moment. There's an energy source. And so algae and biofuels may be an alternative. So long as, like algae, we can use a source which is not a food source and doesn't replace productive agricultural land, because then that has a knock-on effect on food prices.
Well, Paul, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. Paul Lynch is the British Consul General for the Southwestern United States.
And now we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I think that nanotechnology in general and the ability to manipulate and control matter on the nanoscopic level, virtually molecule by molecule, that we have today will continue to provide serious answers to the serious questions that affect us, that include energy, that include clean water, that include health and safety. And I think that we are in a position today that we've never been in before, in being able to use technology to hopefully cure some of the problems that we've created on this planet. This is Tom Levesque. I'm the general manager of the Americas for Nano Inc.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You'll live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting for Oh.